Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani. All rights reserved. Chapter 4. After David left, it took Callie almost an hour to catch George, the schizophrenic cat who spent most of his time among the garbage cans at the Chinese restaurant 2 blocks from her home. Most people would consider leaving George behind an excellent reason for moving. She certainly wanted to because, after 4 years of sincere, time-consuming attempts to establish a good relationship with him, he still made her uneasy. At any given moment, he was as likely to rub his body affectionately against hers as he was to scream at her or lash out with teeth or claws. Worse, his extreme behavior sometimes made Callie feel schizophrenic, too. Given all the other mental problems jostling for space in her psyche, she had no desire to add yet another. Still, if a veterinarian found it hard to be nice to such an animal, who else would? Besides, schizophrenic or not, she and George shared a history. Callie loved Chinese food and had first noticed George as a scruffy kitten slinking behind the trash containers in the alley next to the restaurant where she and David often ate. It took her 2 months to gain the kitten's trust enough for him to let her catch him. Once she did, she immediately neutered him and took him home. Rather than being eternally grateful, he took every opportunity to sneak out of the house and return to his squalid roots, where he engaged in a variety of deviant sexual behaviors, including humping the inevitably wet mop the restaurant owner placed outside his back door to dry. On George's good days, he would gently nibble her toes, hug her with his front paws, or crawl under her shirt while she read. But no matter how pleasurable she found this intimate contact, she could never shake the feeling that he could turn on her in an instant. However, it wasn't the fear of any physical pain that undermined her relationship with the cat. The bulk of the energy of any attack took the form of a god-awful scream he, quite rightly, assumed would cause his target to get out of his way. What kept her from establishing a close relationship with him was her intuitive sense that there was something about him that wasn't quite right, even though she could not define exactly what it was. With a fair amount of effort, Callie finally managed to corner George between 2 garbage cans and stuff the shrieking creature into a carrier without losing any vital body parts to him or alerting any animal lovers who might assume that his ear-splitting outburst signaled animal abuse. Then she loaded him into the van with the rest of the cats and headed for the freeway. Callie named George after her mother's brother, George LeMay, who lived in a large Victorian house in downtown Addison next to the Congregational Church. "You really like animals, don't you?" George had asked her shortly before her 8th birthday. "Oh, yes, yes, I do." Her dark ponytail had bounced in vigorous agreement. "Then we'll just have to see what we can do to help you," George smiled benevolently. From then on, George filled his house with a variety of animals and took Callie to every fair, zoo, and animal event within a day's travel of her home. During this period, she gorged herself on the look and feel of fur, feathers, scales, and soft, cool, leathery amphibian skin. And while she stroked and petted the animals, George stroked and petted her. "That degenerative slime! Men like him should be shot!" Alicia's voice spiraled upward in tone and volume when Callie first broached the subject to her therapist. "No, shooting's too good for those bastards. They ought to rot in hell." Alicia's vehement response gave way to Callie's suspicion that she might be one of those therapists who got into the profession in hopes of resolving their own problems while generating a little income. That, coupled with Alicia's recommended daily affirmations to the mirror to banish the toilet dreams, further convinced Callie that Alicia probably wasn't the therapist for her. On the other hand, the thought of describing all the peculiar details of her past all over again to a new therapist appealed to her even less, including those details about her relationship with George. Although Callie could understand the logic underlying Alicia's support of the well-documented villain-victim view of her relationship with George, she could not accept it because he gave her 2 things she craved that her parents denied her: access to animals and attention. There were worse things in the life of a lonely child than being held, stroked, and petted by a kindly fat man who smelled like rabbit pellets. As Callie knew firsthand, it was far worse not to be held, stroked, or petted at all. "Do you see how your uncle deliberately took advantage of you to fulfill his own perverted needs?" Alicia demanded in a tone that negated any challenge. This early trauma undoubtedly lies at the root of all your problems. Callie nodded submissively, knowing she would discuss the subject as long as Alicia wanted within the limits Alicia imposed, in spite of the fact that these precluded discussing the one element of the relationship with George that troubled her the most deeply. At the time, she had enjoyed it, every minute of it, and felt no regrets about it whatsoever. And why shouldn't have I enjoyed it? Where would have I learned that it was wrong? She wanted to challenge Alicia. I lived in a physical and emotional vacuum. I was a benign, space-occupying lesion that my parents didn't allow to disrupt their normally dysfunctional lives. Can't you imagine how wonderful it felt to be held, to be valued for any reason, even if it turned out to be what I later realized was a perverted one? She would then conclude her mental soliloquy by saying, I always keep coming back to the same thing. George never hurt me. He never told me not to tell anyone any more than Bernice ever told me not to mention Venus. Maybe they threatened me, but I don't think so. Maybe this was just how the LeMay family did things. Of course, she didn't dare share any of this with Alicia because feeling that way didn't fit the victim profile. Nor could she share Alicia's assessment that, regardless of Callie's naivete at the time, once she knew that adults should not fondle children, she should have instantly forgotten any positive feelings and redefined George as vile and degenerate. In Alicia's book, to do anything less was crazy. Nonetheless, and in spite of the fact that George filled a need in her life that circumstances prevented her from filling any other way, once Callie left home for college, she never saw him again. Still, she felt sufficient ambivalence about their relationship that George seemed the perfect name for a kitten with whom she shared an equally ambivalent relationship. For safety's sake, Callie planned to keep all of the cats and carriers as she drove, but she soon became lonely and began letting each of them out to sit with her. Bernice, Venus, and David particularly liked to snuggle under her sweatshirt where she could feel them breathing rhythmically against her bare skin. She liked that too. And even though she now had both the time and the money to stop when and where she wanted, she felt driven to get as far away from Los Angeles as fast as she could, maybe so she wouldn't change her mind and go back. She napped in the van among the carriers and kept driving north until she reached Interstate 70 in Utah. Once she finally started heading east, she alternated between feeling exhilarated and depressed. Somewhere east of the Fish Lake National Forest, she put Bernice back in the carrier and let George out, the first of several mistakes she made that day. Feeling in need of a shower, a real bed, and something to eat other than carrots, apples, and hummus, she registered at a motel a few hours later, her second mistake. It took her a while to sneak the cats and her necessary belongings into the room, but fortunately the place wasn't very crowded. George, being George, was having one of his black days and resisted capture, and she finally gave up and left him in the van with the idea that she would deal with him after she got something to eat. After taking a long, hot shower, she walked to the restaurant adjacent to the motel for dinner. There, a waiter presented her with a menu that consisted almost solely of slab of beef items. "I'll have a tossed salad and a baked potato," she told the waiter, who rewarded her with a condescending glare. Assuming her meager expenditure disgruntled him, she added a piece of chocolate cake to the order. While she awaited her dinner, she observed the restaurant's collection of prints depicting people killing buffalo under a wide variety of circumstances, including a group of soldiers gutting one right above her head. This, coupled with the fact that only a few pickups sporting gun racks occupied the parking lot, caused her to eat her dinner quickly, then head back to her room. Unfortunately, no sooner had she started walking in that direction than two obviously drunk men wearing sweat-stained American Cattlemen's Association caps overtook her from either side.
"Stinking little Bambi lover taking the food right out of our mouths," sneered one. "My granddaddy almost died ranching, and so did my daddy," snarled the other. "If you think I'm going to let a little twit like you rub their noses in it with your fucking sprouts, you've got another thing coming."
Realizing that she had evidently stumbled into a range war that pitted drunk cattle ranchers against California vegetarians, she did her best to mollify them. "You don't understand," she explained respectfully. "I have horrible digestive problems. Meat makes me sick."
The fact that one of them called her a stupid cunt and grabbed her by the arm strongly suggested that she had not made the desired response. She was just about to scream when an attractive man wearing a dark suit and a white shirt materialized out of the shadows and warned off her tormentors. "Whatever you say, Gideon," they glared at him angrily, but they left. She turned to the gentleman who had come to her rescue and thanked him. "No problem," he replied. "My name's Gideon Carter. My folks own this place." Whether he was driven by chivalry or a desire not to bloody the ancestral parking lot, she truly appreciated Gideon Carter's intervention and gladly accepted his invitation for a nightcap at a gourmet coffee bar near the motel. After a few sips of organic Irish coffee made with a double shot of whiskey, she found him an increasingly charming companion, so much so that she didn't notice that he was drinking water. By the time the conversation turned to whether lemon juice or cider vinegar made the better tofu solidifier and she had downed her second drink, the alcohol had generated its usual effect on her libido, and she was in love as well as lust with Gideon Carter. She shivered and leaned into him when he put his arm around her as they walked back to her room. When he lightly kissed her, she put her tongue in his mouth. As they stood outside the door to her room, Gideon said something about his clan being one of the most powerful in the county while he unbuttoned her blouse, and she gazed at him adoringly while thinking, David was too nice to ever do anything this forward. Next, he murmured something about loving the taste of forbidden fruit as he fumbled to undo her bra, which sounded good to her because she considered herself quite a fan of forbidden fruit nibbling herself. But just then she noticed a pair of little yellow eyes staring at her solemnly through the window where the owner of the little yellow eyes dangled on the drapes. "Oh!" she gasped to Gideon, whose family owned this no-pets-allowed establishment. "I have to go now." "Go? Where?" "Into my room, to bed." When she saw the gleam in his eye, she added, "Alone. I'm very tired after my long trip." He looked momentarily flustered, but then politely acknowledged, "You're right to retain your virtue." Naturally, she couldn't tell him that a room full of cats rather than a virtue prompted her response. Instead, she somewhat drunkenly murmured, "It's a pleasure to meet a man willing to accept a woman's pursuit of purity." "You are indeed a pearl among women," he murmured back, clasping her hand earnestly. "Please stay a few days." She started to tell him that she had to be on her way first thing the next morning, but she really didn't. He ran his fingers lightly down her cheek, and the idea of spending some quality time with a nice, clean-cut, white knight kind of a guy who considered her a pearl among women appealed to her. "I'll pick you up at 10 and show you the sights," he promised when she told him she'd stay. She nodded and hastily slid into her room before he had a chance to look inside. Once in bed with the cats and the first of several cups of bad but very strong whiskey-free Inru coffee, Callie put Gideon's name, his white shirt, water consumption, and comments about her virtue together and realized she lusted after a Mormon. She personally had nothing against Mormons or members of any religion except those that practice animal sacrifice. In fact, she knew very little about any religion, despite the fact that as a child she regularly accompanied Bernice to the Addison Congregational Church where, Venus once confided, Bernice hoped to be struck by lightning like Saul on his way to Tarsus. Whereas Sechebald transferred Saul into the Apostle Paul, Bernice hoped it would transfer her into Venus so she could always run barefoot through the house, not just when Howard went off hunting or fishing. Much as its fantasy pleased her mother, it caused Callie to live in mortal fear that God would miss Bernice and zap her by mistake, and she would wind up dancing through the house. This, in turn, caused her to miss much of what the minister said. To Callie's knowledge, no Mormons lived in Addison, although when she was about 10, three of them did appear one hot August Sunday to convert the Shackelfords. "Speak your peace and we will sit here and listen," Howard very formally declared, motioning Bernice and Callie to take their seats on the prickly wicker porch chairs. The three young men in their stiff white shirts and skinny black ties shuffled uncertainly in the broiling sun. Finally, one of them began, "In the book of Genesis..." which did not bode well for Callie's plans to go to the beach, armed with her field guides, and slap a Latin name on any creature that crossed her path. Fortunately, about the time the speaker said that God said something to Zephaniah, and one of the others interrupted and said that, no, God said that to Zechariah, she noticed a bright blue bug on the shrub next to where they stood. While they settled the Zephaniah-Zachariah mix-up, the bug zeroed in on a woolly aphid and stalked the smaller insect with a patience she found breathtaking to behold. Once in position, the blue bug pounced. The aphid fought valiantly but was no match for the larger insect who then ate him. So engrossed did she become in this life-and-death struggle that she failed to notice when the religious presentation ended. Her parents apparently hadn't either, because the entire family jumped with surprise when one of the roving missionaries asked, "Do you have any questions?"
"Nope,"
answered Howard after some lethargic shifting in his chair. "Sounded pretty straightforward to me. Bernice?" "How do you get your shirt so white?" Bernice asked, no doubt nourishing the fantasy that these three represented some angelic trio come to answer her long-standing prayer for conversion. Emboldened by the possibility that her mother had been struck by lightning while she conducted her nature studies, Kelly piped up, "Do you know the name of that blue bug on the bush beside you?" The dazed expression on their faces led Kelly to wonder if their guests had been struck by lightning too, especially when one of them pointed to the bug and mumbled, "We're all God's creatures." "I know that," she replied, somewhat miffed by his lame reply, "but what scientific name did God give that particular creature?" Thus ended Callie's only conscious encounter with a Mormon. Now here she lay, hung over in a motel room in Utah with a bunch of illicit cats, planning to spend the whole day with one. The next morning, Kelly remembered she'd left George in the van all night and, to put it mildly, he wasn't the least bit grateful when she sneaked him into her room for breakfast. Indeed, he immediately dug his claws into one of the chairs in an obvious attempt to rip off its upholstery. This blatant disrespect for private property, to say nothing of her love life, caused Kelly to put him back in the van despite his considerable protests. After donning a conservative navy blue skirt and white blouse, she stood outside admiring the large tree shading the van until Gideon arrived. Kelly and Gideon shared what she considered one of those idyllic, once-in-a-lifetime interludes worthy of a romance novel. To find herself seated across from him that evening in the same coffee bar where they'd discovered their mutual interest in vegetarianism seemed the perfect ending to a perfect day. "We'll have the same as last night, Frank," Gideon told the waiter. Two sips of her Irish coffee and Callie started thinking about forbidden fruit again. Oddly enough, Gideon's mineral water seemed to have the same effect on him, which she considered a good sign. By the time she finished her second cup of coffee, she ached for him so badly she excused herself to use the ladies' room. There she tried desperately to resolve the forbidden fruit, illicit feline conflict threatening to ruin yet another opportunity for conjugal bliss. So fully did the dilemma engross her that she turned the wrong way when she emerged from the brightly lit restroom into the dimly lit hall. Just as she realized the error and turned to retrace her steps, she heard a familiar voice emanating from a nearby office. "Gideon's got it all set up," said a voice that even in her fuzzy frame of mind she recognized as belonging to one of the thugs she'd encountered in the parking lot the previous evening. "He's got the bimbo drunker than a coyote and ought to have her in a sack and get the key to the van before she knows what happened." "Well, he better, because I already got a buyer for it, and if his daddy finds out, he's going to skin us all alive," replied Thug 2, whom she could see sitting behind a large desk in the narrow slit of room revealed by the slightly open door. "Can I pick men or what?" she muttered under her breath. Unfortunately, this news didn't sober her up as much as needed as she crept back to the coffee bar. "Be cool," she told herself. "Sit down and act like everything's fine while you figure out how to get rid of Gideon long enough to call the police." Her string of bad luck continued when, immediately after she sat down, Gideon put his hand on her thigh and suggested they call it a night. "Nice van," he remarked as it came up beside her vehicle a short time later. "Yours?" She nodded, vainly trying to clear her alcohol-addled brain. "Give me the keys," he demanded. "Huh?" she replied, confused by this deviation from the plan. "Aren't you supposed to have sex with me first?" He looked momentarily stunned and growled, "Why screw the cow when you can have the van for nothing, babe?" There are a lot of things a slimy crook can say to a drunk woman in crisis to get her to give him her van, plus a lot more, but that wasn't one of them. "Give me a break, you fake Mormon maggot," she snarled back. In retrospect, that probably wasn't the right thing to say either, because Carter slammed her into the side of the van, and she felt her cheek split when her face hit the side mirror. "I said, give me the keys," he repeated threateningly. "It's open," she gasped, now trying to clear her head and stem the flow of blood from her cheek with her hand. At this point, all those years Callie spent in church with Bernice paid off. As soon as Carter opened the door, an enraged George exploded through the opening at face level. Carter instinctively raised his arms protectively and leaped backwards so fast he tripped and fell flat on his back. By then, Callie felt so enraged herself that she grabbed the emasculator from under the front seat of the van and hit him with it before he recovered enough to get up. She barely grazed his head, but it was enough to keep him down. In spite of the fact that Callie called herself a pacifist, the label represented a long-standing charade. She wasn't a pacifist because she believed in peace. She was a pacifist because she was too afraid to fight. Nonetheless, her psychic recipe contained several survival ingredients that were not so much inert as denied, and these suddenly made themselves known as she hiked up her navy blue skirt and straddled Gideon Carter's semi-conscious body. A rush of long-forgotten veterinary training came back and merged with visions of her father, uncle, ex-husband, and every other man who had ever failed her. In one swift, angry motion, she unbelted and unzipped Carter's slacks, pulled down his briefs, and slid the base of his scrotum between the jaws of the emasculator and held it gently but firmly as she had been taught. And then she began to squeeze. A little for the father who never hugged her, a bit more for the lecherous uncle, still more for the ex-spouse who cheated on her, and still more for this masculine scum who wanted to steal her van. She had no idea how much pressure she would have applied had not the terrified look on Carter's face and his almost inaudible whimper, "No, no, please, please stop," reminded her. She was 5 years old, Howard was gone, and Venus was dancing through the house in her gauzy dress, drunk out of her mind and spinning and leaping with a lighted candle in either hand. On and on she danced, the flame barely missing the flimsy window curtains and the billowing folds of her gown time and time again. For hours, Callie huddled, trembling in the corner, sucking her thumb and chanting inwardly, "No, no, please, please stop." No one deserved to be that frightened. Callie eased the pressure on the emasculator and looked down at the trembling man cowering beneath her. "Don't ever mess with a veterinarian," she told him softly. "You understand?" He nodded dumbly, and she helped him up and watched him hobble slowly away. Once she got the keys out of the van where she'd left them, George materialized looking smug, and the two of them retreated to her room where she threw up and cried both before and after she looked at herself in the mirror. Then while George attacked the chair, she got out her instruments and finest suture, put a pillow in the sink, sat tailor fashion on it in front of the bathroom mirror, and stitched herself up. Considering everything, she thought she did a darn good job. You've been listening to an excerpt from Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani. For more information about this and other books by the author, please visit mmilani.com. The song Irritations into Pearls was composed and performed by Jeff Firestone. For more information about Jeff and his music, please contact him at retromusic@verizon.net. Thanks for listening.